We've had a series of sermons concerning marriage. Mr. Dick and Mr. Reeves have contributed. The messages I wanted to give on that subject are pretty much completed today, but I think what I will do is give something that's sort of a corollary and help you understand that the laws of God are not just arbitrary. The scriptures and the laws and the parameters that God has written down and given to us all have a purpose. There is a much larger purpose to it than what sometimes people understand by just reading the Ten Commandments. The family is a foundational unit that God uses to build with. He created Adam and Eve at creation, and he told them to replenish the earth and to multiply. But it's extremely important because that's what he made it, and he made it so that we could learn lessons to understand about he and his family and how he wanted to have sons and daughters born into his family at the resurrection. Satan, of course, is not part of a family. Satan is not going to be a part of the family of God, and so he has done all he can down through the centuries to disrupt or injure that unit, so that it can be then used as a tool to destroy mankind and to cause grief and sorrow. From the beginning, God intended for families to remain intact, each family member to act in such a way that the integrity of that family unit is protected. I've often wondered, I'm sure you have too, in reading the scriptures, why there are so many chapters on who begot who. You start reading the Bible, and boy, it's exciting. You got Adam and Eve, and they get in this tussle in the garden, and all of a sudden Satan's there, and then all of a sudden they're out, and then you've got all these people who are up to the flood, and it's exciting. And then you get to Genesis 10. In part of 11, it's just, you know, who begat who, and who begat who, and who really cares to begat who way, way back when? Or going through some of Chronicles, where some of the chapters, almost entirely chapter by chapter, are who was the father of who. So you wonder, why is that so important that God put it? Sure. That's just water, right? There's no flavoring or anything in there that shouldn't be in there. Okay. I appreciate it. So we have all these families in the Bible that are very important, and when Jesus Christ was born, it was so important to God that he traced the lineage back through Joseph, his legal father, and mother, and Mary, his actual mother, all the way back to Adam and Eve. We don't have quite the same feeling in this country. Most of us know that we're sort of a hodgepodge of immigrants, mostly from Europe, and most of us can't go back more than two or three or four generations, knowing even who our ancestors were or what their names were. Of course, once you get back more than four or five or six, you've got so many hundreds, sometimes thousands, of ancestors, it almost doesn't matter. But the descendants of Israel are important. The families of Israel, the 12 tribes, they are still important to God. In fact, he says it's so important that their crown or their throne will remain until the time that Jesus Christ returns. The point of what we're going to talk about today is that God's laws protect the family, that many of the chapters we have in the Bible are there to be a buttress and a wall around the family unit. God's laws are not simply arbitrary. They have a very important purpose. And the last message I gave a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that in one of these TED Talks, the lady got up and talked about how it was, you know, she had gone through three divorces by age 28 because she, quote, hadn't found the right person. That's not the truth at all. If she's gone through three divorces, it's because she or her husband or both violated laws and principles in God's Word. Let's go to begin with today to Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. It's in the Ten Commandments. You already knew that when I said Exodus chapter 20. There's a promise attached to honoring your parents. Verse 12 says, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the earth, which the Lord your God is giving you." So in verse 12, there's a promise of life and longevity, and also perhaps inheritance. Your days will be long. You'll be able to live on the land that belonged to your parents and their family. The commitment here is to God. You commit to God to honor your parents. You don't sit down with a list of qualifications as to whether or not your parents are honorable. Now, there's a scripture in Acts that we know very clearly that we ought to obey God rather than man. And if there is a situation where your parents are trying to, you know, get you to disobey God, that's obviously not what you do. But there's a commitment here to God that is reflected in how we treat our family members, and especially our parents, honoring our father and mother. Let's go over to Deuteronomy now, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 16. There are some slight variations in the giving of the law when Moses records it again almost 40 years later as they are going into the promised land, and he reiterates the law to them. There are some slight additions. I believe the one here in Deuteronomy 5 is several verses longer if you add up all the extra words, but certainly the principles are all the same. Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16 says, "Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long, that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you." So honoring your parents, this law prevents rebellion, prevents doing things that are dishonorable against the parents, because all of us have flaws. All of us are not perfect. The only perfect man who ever lived isn't married yet, but he will be someday soon, I hope, when he returns back to this earth. But the important thing here is that we are to honor our father and mother as the Lord has commanded us, not because there is some long list of qualifications that we have to check off. This is one of three commandments that are added to in the second giving of the law. The Sabbath commandment is longer in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And the very final commandment against coveting is also longer in this chapter than it is in Exodus chapter 20. This is a reminder that things will go well if the family unit is protected. Now in verse 18 it says, "You shall not commit adultery." Not violating the marriage covenant is, believe it or not, the most regulated part of your life. There are more verses considering this commandment, specifics about it, warnings against breaking it, than any other commandment. You'd think that murder might be higher, that there might be lots and lots and lots of verses in the Bible that says you shall not murder in this way or that way. I think the total is less than six. The total number of verses having to do with your sexual laws, that's how we are to conduct ourselves in that way, 61 that I was able to count. 61, by far the most important in God's eyes. In fact, if you look at all of them, considering adultery, rape, and all the others, plus incest, the total is 96. 96 laws in God's law for you, specific laws that protect that part of the family relationship. So to think it is, quote, no big thing, as the teenagers are often prone to say, or to discount its importance in God's eyes is a very dangerous ground to tread on. Verse 21 says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife." So the first thing you are not to covet is your neighbor's wife, because sin begins in the mind. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, says in Matthew 8, I believe, verse 32, but it also should say, or could say, out of the abundance of the heart, the person acts. It isn't just speaking, but is also acting. And so these laws are meant to protect our heart, to protect the source of our actions. We mentioned also briefly before that when a man and woman get married, they need to build a wall of protection around their family, so their family unit is not invaded by a third person of any kind. And that could include, like it would be here, your neighbor's wife or some unmarried person. Could also include your own mother and father, because the Bible says you are to leave your mother and father and cleave to each other. And we simply have in our society far too many parents who were not let go, not let their children grow up. And I think perhaps sometimes it's a need of the parents. You know, for a number of years, the United Church of God was a member of the ACA group. That was the American Camp Association for Accreditation. And during the years when United first formed back in 1995, there was a general consensus that we really didn't know how to run camps. We had had camps in the church for years. We had camps at Tanglewood. We had had camps up at Orr at SEP. We would never had the proper safety. How do I know that? Because I sued the Worldwide Church of God for having my daughter having a very terrible compound fracture of her arm at Camp Nawana. It was run up in Washington. And as part of the lawsuit, we had to get their safety manual and all the things they had put together to prevent injuries, and it was non-existent. I served back at SEP one year. My wife and I went down to the waterfront in Orr, Minnesota, and here were kids coming down to swim. There were no lifeguards, none in the swimming area. But there was one certified lifeguard on campus, and guess who that was? My wife, who had no assignment whatsoever. So guess what she did for the rest of the week? She stayed down there on the dock and said, you have to have a lifeguard at this camp. We are not going to have people in this water, 30, 40, 60 kids, and not have a lifeguard. Now, what I'm getting to is this. When we first started with the ACA group, they had very, very good guidelines, excellent manuals. It was an educational process that we should have gone through. It was very beneficial. It was not cheap, but it has really resulted in our camps today being on the highest level of professionalism, not only in organization, but in safety and other things. But the ACA sends out this magazine. They have a monthly newsletter, and I used to get that on email. And a couple of years ago, the big issue was about how things have changed in the last 20 years in running summer camps. And the number one issue that everybody agreed on was that homesickness has been replaced by kid sickness, where parents simply can't stand to be away from little Johnny or Susie for 7 or 8 days, and they're constantly calling the camp, wanting to know how's little Johnny or Susie doing, or constantly wanting to have them call them on the cell phone. Or mom, well, we've had in our camp experience, has been a large number of parents who want to come to camp with their kids. They want to come. They want to be on staff. They don't have any qualifications. They don't know how to teach anything, but they want to come. And sometimes they can work in the kitchen or something. I'm not saying that's never done, but oftentimes the motivation is, you know, I don't want to let my kids out of my sight. So it's no wonder that in our society today, because the church often reflects what's going on in society, that young men and young girls are not growing up. They're not maturing as fast. And so many are staying at home with mom and dad till they're 25 or 30. They're having a difficult time going through what is called launching. Have you ever seen that movie, Failure to Launch? Boy, it's painful to watch because it is so clear about what is happening in our society today. And so we have kid sickness now replacing homesickness. We haven't had homesickness cases at camp in years, not anything, you know, really serious. But what we've had is serious cases of kid sickness. And we have a challenge every year because we don't let electronic devices come to camp. All of the cell phones are locked up, kept under lock and key in the nurse's office, and that's where they stay the whole time at camp. We don't have them coming out, and the campers, of course, can't be using them. And so that makes camp much different than what it's like at home. But the biggest complaints haven't been from the campers, it's been from the parents who want to call little Susie or Johnny or Sally, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day. Well, how will I know if something's gone wrong? Well, you know, we're professionals running these camps, we know that nothing's going to go wrong, and if it is, I will call you. If there's some need, I will call you. Now, what's really funny, and I hope I'm not talking out of turn, was in most cases, after a couple of days, the kids don't want to call mom. They're having a great time at camp. They're with all their friends. Man, they're so busy. They just enjoy the company and the food and the activities. They're having such a great time. And we get this urgent call in the nurse's office, you know, Mrs. So-and-so needs to talk to her daughter or son, whatever. So we call them out of the dorm or whatever, and they go over. And mom just says, well, how you doing? Are you okay? Mom, I'm fine. Click. And they take off. And though that happens, I am not exaggerating. That happens every year. And so I'm just saying what happens when the family unit doesn't allow maturity, and oftentimes that is the case in our society. There is a balance, but part of launching is you teach them first. I used to talk about give them roots and then give them wings. And I think probably in some of our early experience, those of us who grew up in the 60s or even earlier, maybe we had too much in the way of freedom and wings and that sort of a thing, because our parents didn't keep us on a short loose. And the world was different then. It was much easier than it is today to be concerned that your kids were not going to be hurt. And so we have, in this situation here, not coveting your neighbor's wife, is involved in building a fence around your mind, because your mind now belongs to your husband or your wife. Not coveting your neighbor's wife is the first thing we are warned against, and certainly today and in all society down through history, there have been many who would want to be coveted and would flaunt themselves, only now we have all the electronic tools to make it so much easier. But notice that it is first on the list. Now, the death penalty. Violating the family unit often meant the death sentence. Let's go to Exodus chapter 21. I've been working on a sermon. I haven't got it finished yet or even outlined completely. But I'm going to give a sermon soon on the death penalty. Why God instituted it, why God is going to carry it out on about 90% of society when Jesus Christ returns, and the proper biblical understanding of its place in society. But in this case, it seems like extreme punishment. Exodus 21 and verse 15 says, "He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." Doesn't that seem extreme, that a young man or woman who would strike their parents would surely be put to death? Verse 17, "He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." Violating the family unit, even in this case of just verbally or physically striking, could have resulted, in fact, if they followed the guideline here in Exodus 21, would have resulted in the death penalty. We don't see any record of that being carried out in any of the biblical chronology, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18, which is really a commentary on what is going on in Western society today. Everything from Western Europe, Canada, North America, Australia, New Zealand, many of the Israelitish countries have followed the path that they were warned not to follow in this chapter. Because in this chapter it lists the sins that get a people kicked off of their land. That God says these sins are so heinous that you do not even deserve to live in the land that I have given you. So Exodus chapter 18, let's begin in verse 1. "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Eternal, your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. According to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you, you shall not do. Nor shall you walk in their ordinances.'" Now, it's possible to go to history books, history of Egypt, pictorial histories of the pyramids, all sorts of various writers of ancient times have chronicled various things, and they come up with some creative evidence and sometimes some very good evidence for the lifestyle of Egypt and ancient Canaan. But we really don't have to do that because God specifically lists here what he wants the Israelites to avoid. These are the things that the Egyptians did. These are the things, the sins committed by the Canaanites. And he says, you shall not do them or walk after their ordinances. Ordinances could be traditions, could be laws, and it could be simply administrations. "Instead, you shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them." Another rendering of that is they give him life. The statutes and the judgments of God actually give us life. And in the sense of the family unit, they bless that family and prosper it. They bless the family unit and they make it a solid unit by which God can build society. Number one, the very first thing, verse 6, "None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him." Meaning incest. How many laws against incest do you think there are in the Bible? 20. More than murder, more than stealing. Just against this one aspect of breaking the commandment against you shall not commit adultery, the seventh commandment. So there are 20 laws against incest. There is to be no improper contact between family members, step-parents, sister, brother, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, any in-laws, even though they might not be blood-related. These are not just because of, quote, the problems that would come about through marrying someone who is close in blood. These also are about in-laws and others who are connected by marriage legally, because that unit is to be protected. It is not to be violated. It goes on to mention your father, your mother, your father's wife, on and on it goes. There's a long list here. Your son's daughters or grandchildren. And, you know, how often and how painful is it to hear of, you know, children who have been molested? And certainly we don't want to ask for any volunteers, because there are too many. In my wife's work, where she has talked to so many people who have had a variety of disabilities, certainly having been molested or hurt when they were young results oftentimes in schizophrenia, results in being bipolar. The child or person goes into kind of a make-believe world to pretend this is not happening to them. And certainly church is not the place to discuss all of the details. But at some point, just ask my wife what she has concluded, medically speaking, even though she's not a doctor. She has just been in the disability field for many, many years. And just seeing the patterns and how people end up with certain types of mental illness, knowing what went on in their background, and she's discussed them with a few professionals who have PhDs and MDs, and they have not disagreed with her. They've agreed, yes, that could be the cause. So we have in verse 17, very plain statement. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter, nor shall you take her son's daughter nor her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are near of kin to her. It is wickedness. Again, this is not because of some blood issue or some problem that would result from a baby being born. This is because they have a family unit, and we are commanded by God not to violate it. Very important that God protects this unit, not because of some reason men can come up with, but because it is so. This is not to be done. And going through all of these, you wonder, why are there so many verses here that are so specific about who you are not allowed to touch? Well, the answer is God said so, because it protects the family that he created. And in fact, if this was completely obeyed, what a great society we would have, or a much, much better society than we have now. Verse 18, you shall not take a woman as a rival to her sister. And verse 19, mentions about her impurity and customary impurity and adultery. Verse 20, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. And how many Hollywood movies have been based on, you know, somebody else's wife and a man committing adultery? This leads to verse 21, the fact that after the family unit has been assaulted and the walls have been torn down, that children are then expendable. It says, you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech. Molech was a Canaanite god, and you can see pictures of him, of various statues of Molech online. If you go to the British Museum, there's a very good display of the Canaanite gods. But he has his arms outstretched. They would build a fire beneath those arms, and they would put live babies on there and let them be burned alive to this false god called Molech. God says, you shall not profane the name of the Lord your God, because I am the Eternal. You know, God later says that these are his children. He told the Israelites, you defiled my children, because children belong to God, not to us. And that's a concept we have a hard time understanding, that when children are born, we have the responsibility from God to raise them, to train them, to teach them when we're rising up, when we're sitting down, when we're going by the way, when we're going in and out of our houses. We're to teach them God's way, but essentially they belong to him, not to us. And eventually we turn them over to him. And how many of us as parents have had the experience of taking our daughter or our son off to college and then coming back to an empty bedroom with the realization, she's gone, or he's gone. They're not coming back. And then you think, wow, did I do a good job? You know, did I teach them all that I should have? Do they have a God they can turn to now, because they can't turn to me? I'm too far away. And I will say that daughters do have a way of still calling you up and wanting you to solve their problems, right? You've probably all experienced that. We won't ask for volunteers, but I remember after my daughter Holly was over in Africa, she was waiting to go into medical school, she volunteered at a clinic over in Gaborone, Botswana. And after a while, I realized it'd be much cheaper to fly over there and visit her than to pay for all these international phone calls at the time. So she calls me up one time. I'm sitting in the office in my little house in Gig Harbor, and she goes, and then, oh man, someone's hurting my daughter. She says, I said, what happened? So my first instinct is to turn around to my gun safe, get one of my pistols, and say, I'm coming over, Holly. Whoever's hurting you, I'm going to stop him. Of course, she realized you can't fly with one, but that's my first thought. How can I go help her? So finally, I said, calm down. What is going on? I'm getting panicky and worried. And she said, the baby died. I said, what do you mean? She said, I was holding a baby and it died in my arms. And she goes, oh, she's crying. I said, well, Holly, you're going to be a doctor. You are going to see people die. Now, the rest of the story, though, is I think the tragic part is that, and remember this pretty accurately, this mother, they had a long rash of a very severe diarrhea in the water in Gaborone that year because of the high water, and the mothers were bringing the babies in after they were almost dead to the clinic. If they brought them in earlier, they could have saved them. So this native lady brings her daughter in, or bring a little baby into the clinic, and my daughter was there as the assistant, and then there was an American medical doctor, and there were several nurses that were all, employees at the hospital. And so the nurses were on break out in the tea room. The mother brings this baby in, and the American doctor is screaming, get me supplies, I think we can save the baby. And so they kept screaming at these African nurses who were out there having tea, and they didn't move. And so the doctor is screaming at my daughter, Holly, get me the syringe, get me the whatever. And so the doctor and my daughter were opening all the cabinet doors and trying to get all these supplies. They didn't know where the supplies were. And so the doctor gave the baby to my daughter, who then was holding the baby while the doctor's trying to get all the needles and supplies, and the baby dies. So the American doctor went in and told the African nurses what he thought of him, and they just looked up at him and said it was Allah's will. If God wanted the baby to live, it wouldn't have come in here on our tea break. And so this entire experience was very traumatic for my daughter, and it does tell you something about the differences in cultures, that they believe so much in this predestination thing. And there are many, many, many other examples you could probably quote if you did some research in history. But the important thing to understand is the family members are so important to God that he protects them in every way. And I think the history shows that the people of Israel have valued babies more than any others in the other cultures until perhaps in recent times. Let's continue on down. You shall not lie with the male as with a woman. It is an abomination. There are 9 direct commands in the Bible forbidding homosexuality, more than there are against murder, as I mentioned before. It's a crime against the family. It's a crime against society. But as you know, we've had a very dominant, very pushy homosexual movement the last 30 or 40 years that has completely changed the landscape of this country with regards to that behavior. But how it applies to us is pretty simple. We used to have to warn our little girls to stay away from men, but now you have to warn little girls to stay away from some women, warn the boys to stay away from men. It's one of those playthings where it's not the same society that it was, that those who are arrayed against us trying to destroy your family and your children are far more numerous and far more accessible and far more pushy than they used to be. Verse 23 also involves something you're going to see more in the news, bestiality. We don't need to talk about it in church, but it is one of those things that is simply the natural progression of this progression of sin. Verse 24 says, do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled. The nations are Egypt and the Canaanites, the Canaanite nations. This is what they were doing. This list of their activities that got them kicked off of their land, because the Egyptians were kicked off of their land. Of course, we know Pharaoh and his army died, and eventually the Hyksos came in and took over. You go to Egypt today, the people that populate that land are not the native Egyptians that were pictured on the sides of the pyramids and the various tombs that archaeologists have found. And certainly the people of Canaan are no longer the same either. It says, by these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. The land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. These things defile the land along with every family unit, and it is taking place all around the nations of Israel, all over the world. If we continue, we will certainly see those lands taken over by strangers and the Israelites kicked out. Let's go to Deuteronomy now, Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy 22. This is an interesting set of verses here, because it shows that in God's eyes, rape is the equivalent of murder. My wife and I were just briefly watching the news the other night, and somebody committed this violent crime here in Portland, and they said he'd been convicted previously of 3 rapes. So why in the world is he still out walking around? You know, why do we have so much leniency for criminals whom God says should be severely punished, and we let them out on our streets so they can ply their trade and punish other people, people who are essentially law-abiding? Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 22, if a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. It doesn't say they shall be portrayed in movies and TV and talk about how wonderful it is. It simply says both of them shall die. The man that lay with a woman and the woman, so you shall put away evil from Israel. So we have here a very serious statement about how serious this is in the eyes of God. It is not appropriate subjects for entertainment. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has humbled his neighbor's wife. So it shows that his betrothal is a legal marriage, simply is not consummated yet. So shall you put evil away from you. But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her, then only the man shall die. You shall do nothing with the young woman, because had she screamed, or maybe she did scream, and nobody could come to her assistance. Verse 27, for he found her out in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, but there was no one to save her. So very simple here to see that this is extremely important in God's eyes. Verse 26 simply says, they shall be punished as if it were murder. It's on the same level of destroying a person's life or destroying the family structure as the Sixth Commandment. I mentioned there, in addition to the 61 laws that protect the family unit in the Decalogue or the books of Moses, there are 96 specific sex laws in the book. All of them are part of this massive wall that God has built around the family that he described. Now, there's also some positive aspect to it. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 5. Now, I truly wish there were a way we could implement this and do it every year, do it as it comes to pass in a person's life. It might prevent some of the divorces and some of the family issues that we have had. But essentially, a man was supposed to spend a year cheering up his wife. Now, think about your first year marriage. Does this describe you? Verse 5, Deuteronomy 24. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. How many stories from World War II and from Vietnam do we know of where a soldier got married and it took off the next day and went to war and never came back, got killed? I had some friends in high school that did that, got married, went to Vietnam, never came back. Or it says, shall not be charged with any business. So he doesn't even have to work. He gets married, gets a year off. Apparently is fed and clothed and housed okay. He shall be free at home for 1 year and bring happiness to his wife, whom he has taken. Now, we could probably all talk about our first year married. Our first year married, I had 6 different jobs. My wife knew she had a winner. She knew this was going to turn out really, really good. You know, could hardly pay any bills, drove an old truck, an old car, an old Dodge Dart that puffed blue smoke whenever you started it. And she couldn't start it that often because it just didn't cooperate with her. But we could talk about cardboard furniture and talk about the struggle of, you know, working as a waiter late at night trying to make ends meet and the work that she did too, because this is not followed in our society. Nobody said, take a year off, we'll pay for all your expenses. Instead it was, you guys are going to have a really tough time because you're young, broke, and in love, but other than that, you don't have much going for you. And there's a lot of stories, I'm sure, along that line, especially with the older couples. But what if we could do this? What if there were a society where not only every family had their own plot and they had their own land, and families were all protected because people kept the laws of God? that when a man married a wife, he had a year off. And it says, bring happiness to his wife. So they go pick flowers and bring them to her. They can go for long romantic walks on the beach. They could do all of these wonderful things that would bring happiness to his wife. It also tells you that God wants husbands to bring happiness to your wives as part of the purpose of getting married. But it's a very positive thing because this is one more of God's laws or principles that is a wall around the family, that a young man and young woman getting married should start out on a firm foundation, should start out making each other happy. They shouldn't start out with nothing but, you know, laundry and bills and food you can't buy and all sorts of other things, cars broken down. So our society has it sort of upside down in this way, as it does in so many other ways. But what a proof that God intended a man and his wife to be bound together and to love each other for their entire lives. Now, once we understand that such a significant part of God's law is designed to protect the family unit, then how does that really apply to us? Now, let's go over to Romans chapter 8 and verse 1. Romans chapter 8 and verse 1 is a very convenient scripture for those who teach the law is done away to avoid, because it doesn't fall into that category. Romans 8 and verse 1, begin a section here of five verses. There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. So once we are converted, we are called in the Bible term here by the Apostle Paul in Christ Jesus, because we have his Spirit. We don't walk according to the flesh. We don't live according to physical needs or physical desires anymore, but we are led by the Spirit of God. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. There's a law that if we are led by the Spirit, we are no longer bound by the law of sin and death. What the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh on account of sin. He condemned sin in the flesh. And the weakness of the law was lack of forgiveness and lack of a way being made, a penalty being paid so the sin could be forgiven. But notice verse 4, that the righteous requirements of the law might be fulfilled in us. Now today we read some of those laws, Leviticus 18, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. The righteous requirements of the law, and in particular, I would say the laws regarding the family, are to be fulfilled in us. And if we don't fulfill it, then we are not living according, as it says here, to the Spirit. But instead, we are living according to the flesh. And if we had, I think, a more specific understanding of what this verse means, the righteous requirements of the law, how much better would we be at obeying God? How much more rewarding would our Christian life be? I think it certainly would be with Sabbath keeping, really understood, Isaiah 58 and other places about not doing our own things on the Sabbath, but using that day as a day to draw closer to God. So the righteous requirements of the law, and there are 93 of them that regulate your sexual behavior, there are dozens more that are simply bulwarks around the family unit. All those requirements are to be fulfilled in your life. Now, we certainly are all aware of attacks on our physical families. That goes without saying. Satan hates the family unit, and he has been at war with it ever since day one. The first thing he did was deceive Eve, and then she had her husband sin, and it's been kind of a mess ever since. You've heard that old saying, probably, that God created the earth and rested, then God created man and rested, and then God created woman, and since God, earth, nor man has rested. So this is saying, may not be true, but certainly might be a little bit of truth in it, because after Eve was created, then Satan entered the picture and things turned out to be a little more of a challenge. We need to be aware, at least I think we need to be aware from an historical perspective, of some of the movements, and especially those that have been written down in important books, that have caused this sea change in our society and have essentially been attacks against the family unit that have come out in the last century. We could go back earlier, but I'll start in 1963. Perhaps the most influential book written in the 1960s was a book called The Feminine Mystique, published by a woman named Betty Friedan. It's widely credited with sparking the wave of feminism in the United States. In 1957, Friedan was asked to conduct a survey of her former Smith College classmates for their 15th anniversary reunion. She simply went around to all of her classmates, all of these women, Smith College, I believe, was an all-women's college, asked them about their lives and whether or not they were happy and what made them happy and what they wanted to do. She originally intended to publish simply an article, but she decided to publish an entire book. And during the year 1964, a year when the year after President Kennedy had been assassinated, and of course Lyndon Johnson was president, and during that time all these massive, massive welfare programs were being passed, it became the best-selling book. In the book, Friedan challenged the widely shared belief that fulfillment meant being a wife and a mother, a housewife. She shed light on the plight of the American woman. She called it The Problem That Has No Name. The Problem That Has No Name was the subtitle of her book. And the problem was all of her Smith College friends, classmates, who had graduated 15 years earlier, were now mothers and wives, and they were basically unhappy. And so then she concluded that being a mother and a wife and taking care of a family and raising children was the cause of unhappiness. And they needed to then abandon that calling and that role in life and find their way in the man's world and indeed become men in function and in purpose. Through interviews with American housewives, Friedan discovered that many of them suffer from a pervasive and unexplained sense of dissatisfaction, which she called the problem that has no name. She chased the return of women to domestic life after their pre-war emancipation. In other words, World War II had many, many women working as Rosie the Riveter. Many of our factories that made munitions were staffed primarily by women laborers. And then after the war, many of them got married, had children. Of course, that became the large generation, the baby boomers. But she says here, women were socially pressured into becoming homemakers by this feminine mystique, which was an idolized image that she says caused women to be unhappy. She concluded that the life of a housewife prevents women from developing full autonomous identities. And she argues that both men and women must reject that role, and she encouraged women to find self-fulfillment through other avenues. In chapter 14, the final chapter of The Feminine Mystique, Friedan discusses several case studies of women who have begun to go against that mystique. She advocates a new life plan for women, including not viewing housewife as a career, not trying to find total fulfillment through your husband or your marriage or motherhood, but finding meaningful work that uses their mental capacity. I guess being a mother doesn't entail mental capacity. I can't figure that one out, but from what I've seen, I think it actually does. It's just my opinion. But let me continue here. She discusses the conflicts some women may face in this journey of self-actualization, including overcoming their own fears and resistance from others. For each conflict, Friedan offers examples of women who have overcome it, and she ends her book by promoting education and meaningful work as the ultimate method by which American women can overcome this problem that has no name. Now, along with that, we had 54 welfare programs passed in 1964 and 5. The government began to take on the responsibilities of the father. And in the American family unit, it became very easy to have illegitimate children, be rewarded for it financially, and then the men were just left to do whatever they wanted to do. The result, years later, 2015, is that more than 40% of all babies born in the United States are born to unmarried mothers. Since 1940, when the percent was less than 3%, it has gone up to 40.6%. This according to CNSNews.com, an article about the U.S. babies born to unmarried women increases for the eighth straight year. In 2008, 40.6% of the babies born in the U.S. were born to unmarried women. 2009, 41%, and it's hovered right at the 40 to 41% level ever since then. The preliminary birth rate for unmarried women in 2015 was 43.5 births per 1,000 unmarried women aged 15 to 44. And of course, what you have as a result of that is families that are dysfunctional, often families that are not on the production level as far as accomplishment goes. I'll tell you one more story about my daughter. My daughters get mad at me for mentioning them in sermons, so I'll try not to say too much. But when my daughter Holly was accepted to medical school at the University of Washington, which is rated now as the number one medical school in the country, she was also accepted at Harvard and UPenn and a couple others, and she turned down Harvard to go to University of Washington, as did some of her roommates. In the opening freshman session, and I believe it was something like 3,700 applications, most of which were 5-4-point students, the highest achievers in the country. Of that, there were about 240 applicants that made it, so the percentage of those who were accepted was basically less than 1% of those, and these were all the highest achievers in the country. And my daughter retold this story to us, that they divided the room up, had all the people, all these candidates, and these are all brilliant young men and women who had struggled, you know, they had done the very best possible in their undergraduate years, plus they had to do volunteer work. It's one reason why she was over in Gaborone, Botswana, volunteering in a hospital over there. That looks good on your resume to apply for school. So they began to ask, the administrators did, you know, how many came from, this is all sort of a social engineering thing. They wanted to know how many came from various groups, you know, various whatever ethnic groups, various what other groups, but at one point they asked, all those who still have mother and father at home stay on this side, those who grew up in broken homes on this side. 10 moved. 10 out of 250, 260 of the top achieving kids in this country, 240 came from a home where mom and dad were still there. And guess what mom and dad were doing? Do your homework? Do you clean your room? Do you help kill chickens? Did you help mow the lawn? Mom and dad were harsh taskmasters. So how many of you moms and dads are pretty harsh taskmasters? All I can say is congratulations. That's tough. Mom, yeah, I know. My wife always says, you're the old softy. The kids would always ask, Mom, can I do this? She'd say, no. They'd say, well, I'm going to get another opinion. And then she'd yell in my room, don't you dare! And I always, most cases I did dare, and said, yeah, go ahead. And of course, got me in big trouble, but that's okay. All three of the kids turned out okay. But anyway, it's interesting that God's way still works, no matter how much the society wants to pretend that single motherhood is successful, that broken homes do a great job raising great kids. No matter how much they want to pretend that everything on the outcome side has no cause, it's all wrong. The facts simply don't back them up. But God's law does. And these laws that protect the family do hold up. The evidence is there to show that God was right all along. Let's go down to Psalm chapter 68. Psalm chapter 68. It says, God sets the solitary in families. You know that's true when someone is called into God's church. Oftentimes, people that come to church for the first time, it was very true in my earlier years. So many of the young people I knew at Ambassador College and in the church in those years, they were the only one connected with their family that understood the truth. And oftentimes, it is people that are alone. But God sets the solitary in families. I think that perhaps is fulfilled in three ways. Number one, when you become a part of a church family, which means a lot. Secondly, in the kingdom of God, we're going to be part of God's family forever. And those who are solitary or perhaps have lived alone for much of this life are going to be part of the largest and most wonderful family in all of creation and history. But there's another way, and that I think is in the sense of, you know, adopted grandparents and parents. And it's so wonderful when little kids come to church and they got this adopted grandma and that adopted grandpa, and we'd all tell some wonderful accounts of that, but all I can say is it meant a great deal to my three kids growing up. They would come to church with their backpack or their lunchbox, just hoping that somebody would invite them to come over, because they truly did not like going to two churches every single Sabbath. And so it is true joy now, and after going to true churches almost every Sabbath for 41 years. I'm occasionally able to spend a morning at home and send somebody else to Hood River. So I really do appreciate that because it has been a lot of years. And after the kids get a certain age, the two church a day thing just isn't attractive anymore, plus the two and a half hour drive between services. So God sets the solitary in families, and don't devalue your value, your contribution to the youth in the church, because you can be an adopted grandma or grandpa and make friends with the youth, but you need to do it when they're young. You can't wait till they're 16 and then try to become their friend. It's better to do it when they're younger and have them know that you are a friend that they can see at church every week. God's laws protect the family because God is building a family. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14. We all know that in Ephesians 5, it says very plainly that the husband-wife relationship, Paul says, I speak of Christ and the church. And we've discussed that in some of our messages here on this subject. But in a larger sense, the entire family unit that God created is because God is a spiritual family, or is building a spiritual family. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14 and 15, it's one of those things where Paul just sort of says it like you all understand this and goes on. I wish he would have spent more and more time explaining in detail what he's referring to. But it is an accepted truth he knows his audience already understands. He says, for this reason I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, from whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. So there is a family in heaven and earth, a godly family. They are named after the Father. Is he referring to all the angels? Is he referring to all those who have his spirit? As we cry, Abba, Father, or we're able to say we are part of God's family, not born again as sons yet, but we are adopted. So is that part of what he's referring to? I think it probably is. But he talks about the whole family in heaven and earth that is named after God the Father. He simply follows that he would grant you according to the riches of his glory to be strengthened with might through his spirit in the inner man. So he wants this family to be protected, to be strong, to understand that we have riches and glory, spiritually speaking, in the future. But this whole family that is named after God is the model for the family that God created for you and I each to experience. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 12 for some more evidence on the same thing. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 22. He mentions here that this is a group of people who are registered in heaven. It says in verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion. So we don't come to Mount Sinai with the great smoke and the fire and the earthquake and the sounds and the trumpet and all of that. We're not the Israelites at Mount Sinai. Instead, we come to Mount Zion, typifying the third heaven where God lives, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels. So when we pray in our mind, I hope we have at least occasionally a vision, a sense anyway in our mind that we are bowing to Mount Zion in the third heaven, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, surrounded by an innumerable company of angels. Notice we've also come to the general assembly and church of the firstborn. On Pentecost, we talk about the first fruits. This is the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. It's also called in other places the book of life. The book of life, that God has the names of all of those who will be in the first resurrection. To God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. He's talking about those that are part of the family named after God mentioned in Ephesians chapter 3. That we've come to Mount Zion, which has as our leader the focus of our family, the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, surrounded by all those angels, and we are coming to the general assembly and church of the firstborn. We have come to a church of those who are going to be in the first resurrection. And I certainly pray and hope that includes all of us in this room. To God, the judge of all, who made the spirits of men perfect. So we get a very beautiful relationship, beautiful picture here about this group, this family that we are called to. I want to drop back now to Romans chapter 8. I know we were there, but let's go back, because later in the chapter, he mentions that we are heirs right now, We have not yet received the inheritance, but yet we are still a part of the family that is enumerated. This family that has the name of God, that is the pattern for our humanly families, and that tells us why it is so important that God put well over 100 laws in his Bible to protect it, because it is going to be the family that will rule the universe forever. It says in Revelation, we'll be given the morning star, which basically means, you know, all the heavens. In Romans 8 and verse 14, as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. Now, they're your sons, even if they're not born yet. Now, I remember the olden days when nobody found out what their baby's sex was until they were born. And even mother and father were surprised. Now they get all these sonograms and all these various images, and, you know, they know. In fact, they sometimes can do the blood test just a week or two after the mother's pregnant and find out even from that. We talked to some people who did that here recently, that just within a few weeks of conception, they were able to find out, you know, about their child. But back then, a person had a baby growing in mom, and they didn't know what it was until it was born, except that it was their son or their daughter. It was part of their family. The same way now, we are not yet born into God's family, but we are still part of the family. As many as are led by the Spirit of God, that is the acid test, these are the sons of God. You did not receive the spirit of bondage, again, to fear. In other words, fear of being punished, fear of the death penalty. But instead, we receive the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry out, Abba, Father, that we have been adopted into the family. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. Now, what did Jesus Christ say he inherited? What did he say back at the end of the book of Mark? That all things in heaven and earth have been given to him. So if he inherited all things in heaven and earth, and we are to be joint heirs with Christ, what do you think we are in line to inherit if we are in the first resurrection? Well, part of all things. That would be quite an inheritance. That would dwarf any money that Uncle Fred or Uncle Sam or Grandpa Bill could leave you. It would make Ed McMahon look like a pauper on the street begging. I don't think he's in business, though. I think that Publishers Clearinghouse went bankrupt, and he's not walking around balloons knocking on people's doors anymore. But we are to be joint heirs with Christ, heirs of God, and Christ says he's inherited all things. What, it's something we cannot simply comprehend. We simply, it's just in our mind, we can think about it, but we simply are not there yet. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. There will come a time when all of the trials and sufferings will simply be meaningless. Just simply meaningless. You know, when a mother has a new baby, she doesn't talk about the pain or the experience of labor. She's just thrilled with the little baby that's now laying on her and getting to know her mom, and mom's getting to know her or him. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. That's because only God knows who's led by his Spirit. We can't drive down the street with a ray gun and point at various houses or people and say that person is or isn't. Only God knows. And those are going to be revealed at the first resurrection and when Jesus Christ returns. So if the righteous requirements of the law are to be fulfilled in our lives, and the law of God is a wall of protection around the family unit, and we are to be part of the family of God, then we have a tremendous responsibility to do all that we can to protect that unit intact and never let harm come to our family unit. In God's eyes, we are to protect our families here on earth as much as we are to protect our spiritual life and dealings with him as our great God and Father. Satan is a great poacher. He's like a coyote running around killing your animals. He is the father of lies. He was a murderer from the beginning. He's the serpent, the tempter, the wicked one, and many more things. And how does he try to hurt us? Let's go over to Revelation chapter 12. Satan's main tool, other than obviously temptation and a society that he is the principal author of, we live in the society of Satan the devil, the principal tool that Satan uses to hurt us, to break our relationships apart. I think it's the beginning of damage in some of our families, is accusing. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9, the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world, and he was cast out to earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So Satan is cast out. Verse 10 says, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. You know, it hurts our father and older brother when we accuse each other. I remember one time my brother was 16 months older than I. By the time I was 3, I was bigger than him because he simply had a smaller frame. And for the most part, we got along really well. We did things together. But there were a few times we got in some real knockout, drag-out fights. I'm sure it never happened in your families. You probably always got along marvelously with your brothers and sisters. But there were a couple times when we really socked each other out. I mean, we were both, I think, pretty athletic. And so one time we got in a little fight, and actually it was a pretty big fight, followed by a bunch of yelling. And we were in the house, and I looked over. My mom was standing there crying. My mom was standing there just crying her eyes out. And we both stopped. And I said, what's wrong with you? She says, it hurts me so much when my sons are hurting each other. How much does God hurt when we hurt each other? How does it make your father feel when you say slanderous things about your husband or your wife or other church members? Remember that thing in Romans? Who are you that judges another man's servant? We are God's servants. We're not yours. How do you think you can judge another man's servant and get away with it? So accusing is what Satan does. And I would just like all of us to think about what we say and how much we accuse or say. You know, family members, we get very comfortable. It's easy to cross barriers and lines that you wouldn't do with your neighbor across the street. Sometimes families, we used to call it, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, familiarity breeds a lack of boundaries that you get erased. I think sometimes we need to build those boundaries back up and protect ourselves. You know, if Satan's job is to accuse, we need to ask ourselves, why would we do his job for him? And the answer, of course, is that we shouldn't. I want to end the day on Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23. We could go all the way through verse 25 about assembling ourselves together, but you understand that's what we're doing here on the Sabbath. It says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. God is faithful. He gave us laws that protect us. He gave us rules and laws that protect our lives. He gave us commandments that he said if we keep them, will result in a blessing for us and our posterity. God is always faithful. And Paul simply says here, let us hold fast what we confessed, what we promised we would do at baptism, because that is what we are expected to do until the return of Jesus Christ. So God has made you part of a family. He's made you part of a physical family. He's made the invitation to you to be a part of his spiritual family forever. And don't forget that his laws protect the family unit.